From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Tis the season of pomp and circumstance. Across the country, college students are walking across the stage to receive hard-earned diplomas. But before crossing that threshold, many countless hours have been spent in labs, in archives, in forests and ponds, researching their senior theses. This hour on Point, our annual salute to the senior thesis. Join us, won't you? College seniors, are you breathing a sigh of relief having turned in your own thesis just in time? For those of you who wrote your theses long ago, do the topics you chose then still resonate today? Or do you even remember what you wrote about? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook, where they're at On Point Radio. Well, who better to ride along with me again this hour for this salute this year than my high school classmate in Sacramento, California, Tim Grieve, lover of great writing with children of his own in college. Until recently, he ran the news division for McClatchy Newspapers. He's now working on a new publication that will focus on technology, business, and politics. Tim, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Jane. Great to be here.
Great to have you. Seems to be a favorite, a fan favorite this hour. So here we go again. You ready?
I am ready. This is exciting and a little bit intimidating.
All right. First up, Hannah Newcomb joins us from Salem, Massachusetts. She graduates from Salem State University this week. She studied geology and is originally from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Her thesis is titled, well, Hannah, you give us the title, won't you?
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Yeah. So my title is called The Late Pleistocene to Mid-Holocene Paleolimnological Variability Preserved in the Sediment of Walden Pond.
You get an A.
How did such a serene place get hitched with such an intense title? That's what I want to know.
Well, to make it simple, their geologic periods of time are given pretty, exciting names, I should say.
Yeah.
And to make it simple, it's an ice age, so the Younger Dryas, to the mid-Holocene climactic optimum, which was the thermal maximum. Paleolimnological is the study of past lakes. So we're looking at a lake, and we're looking at an ice age to a thermal maximum and what we can see preserved in the mud there at Walden Pond.
Okay, so you got your hands dirty with this one.
I did.
Essentially, right, looking at sediment from Walden Pond, dating back, as you say, all the way to the ice age. What'd you find?
So we took 9 meters of core at Walden Pond, and we found that different isotopes, so we looked at carbon, nitrogen, and sulfur, they all have different reactions to temperature. And so if we were looking at the ice age up until our thermal maximum, which is a lot warmer, we can see distinct shifts in what the carbon and the nitrogen and sulfur are doing. And to put it on more simple terms, we're able to relate those three isotopes to things that are commonly happening in a lake setting. So we looked at carbon, which we relate to productivity. So what are little biological critters doing? How are they eating? Are they dying? Are they living? Nitrogen, we can relate to the kind of plants and what plants are doing in the area. And then the sulfur, we look at to see what are the actual conditions in the water column looking like. Is there a lot of wind? Is it being mixed well, the water? And so we actually found some pretty cool things. In the ice age, we can see that there are not a lot of plants growing, which kind of makes sense. We can see that there's not a lot of activity happening with the little critters. And we see that in an ice age, when it's dry and windy, there's actually a lot of mixing going on in the water column. And then we're able to see a shift, actually, because at the thermal maximum about 5,000 years ago, we see a huge increase in plants. We see a huge increase in critters, and we see less of the windy mixing going on in the water.
Mm. So I did a little research myself last night and discovered that Walden Pond is a famous example of a kettle hole, right?
Yes,
Henry David Thoreau's famous spot. It was formed by retreating glaciers 10, 12,000 years ago. So why did you choose this spot, Hannah?
Well, Walden Pond is obviously famous by Henry David Thoreau, but also it's Massachusetts' deepest lake, and it has never been studied before on the at the extent that I was able to. So my advisor, Brad Huberny over at Salem State University, he got a grant to actually go out to Walden Pond and take the longest core that's ever been retrieved from there. So me as well as some other scientists internationally, actually. So I'm in a group of international scientists that are working on this project that's never been done before. And when we retrieve the core, you're actually right. There is evidence for retreating glaciers. So at the base of the core, there's these sandy layers, and glaciers are huge, and they can deposit big grained sediment. So there's some sand at the base of the core, and that's our evidence of glaciers.
Mm. Tim Grieve, what do you think? A college senior holding her own with these international scientists.
Well, I'm mostly impressed. I understand the way you did this was taking centimeter-sized samples of mud every 8 or 9 centimeters for days and days and days on end. Is that right?
Yes, it took.
Did you ever think, man, I could be out drinking beer or binge watching reality TV like a normal college student?
Oh, we do it both.
Multitask.
I put the Netflix on and do the mindless task of taking all those samples. But it really did take a long time, and I was so excited when it ended.
So what's the lesson for us today? What did you conclude after all of your research, Hannah?
Well, I think it's really exciting that we can use Walden Pond as an area for research when understanding climate change between Ice Age and to now. And this is before humans, so we know that climate change is happening before humans. And I'm excited because hopefully we're going to soon be releasing the full record when we can see when humans come into play and how over a long period of time we have climate change, but how will this accelerate with humans?
Mm. Well, Thoreau would be proud of you, Hannah Newcomb. Thank you very much. 22-year-old from Falmouth, graduating from Salem State on Saturday. Her thesis is titled, here we go, Late Pleistocene to Middle Holocene, Paleolimnological Variability Preserved in the Sediments at Walden Pond. Hannah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. All right, Tim. Brittany Brown is joining us next. She's from Oxford, Mississippi. She graduates from the University of Mississippi with a degree in journalism on Saturday. She's from Quitman, Mississippi. Her thesis is titled The Latino South, Race and Racialization. Brittany, great to have you with us. Hi. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Say hi to Tim Grieve.
Hi, Tim. How are you?
I'm great, Brittany, and this is a fascinating topic you've chosen. As I think you've written, there's a divide in the South that we think of typically, very clearly binary divide between black and white, and you're looking at the questions of how Latinos fit in and fit themselves into that divide. What did you find?
Yeah, so the South still very much so like operates in this racial binary where things are very black and white, and if you don't fit into either one of these categories, then where do you fit in? Do you have to assimilate into one of the categories? Do you create your own space? And so through interviewing about 23 students at the University of Mississippi who identify as Latino, I found that it's really interesting how students end up falling into either the category of black or white or creating their own space. And so I found that it's really changing with the increased Latino population here in the South, especially in these non-traditional areas in the South where you don't see a large Latino influence, not, you know, Florida or Texas, but places like here in Mississippi or Alabama or even in rural areas in Georgia, not necessarily Atlanta because there is a large Latino population there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really affecting the way race operates on a small scale, and I think as time continues, eventually, we're no longer going to be, I think, dedicated or committed to this black-white racial binary that's here in the South. And so I'm really excited to see how things change, even as I, you know, continue to do this research. But it was really interesting to talk to students firsthand about their own experiences.
I'm sure it was. And Brittany, your father is Puerto Rican. Your mother is African American. How did this all make you reflect on your own identity?
Yeah, so growing up, there were always a lot of questions. People always ask me, you know, what my race was or what my ethnicity was, where I'm from, what languages do I speak? And you'd be amazed at the questions or the looks that I get. I don't know, it's just really interesting being here in Mississippi. I've grown up in Mississippi most of my life, and so these are questions that I've always had to answer. And so with this research, I just wanted to see if these were questions that other students had to answer. And, how do we deal with these things? How is our presence as Latinos and other Latinos across the South affecting the way we're viewed here in the South?
Tim, last question for you.
Yeah. What in your own life, how do you find yourself making this path? Do you find yourself gravitating to sort of identifying with one group or the other, or as you said, finding that third route?
Yeah. So one of the major conclusions I found in my research is that race is a spectrum. And I think in this country, in the South especially, we look at it as this very, very concrete thing. Now, I'm not saying that the implications of race or the effects that people live every day because of race is not like real or concrete, but race itself, race as an organization is not real. And so it, just going back to like the 1600s and understanding how race was established, and understanding now after interviewing so many students, whenever I got to that question, what is your race? What is your ethnicity? And none of the students could just say, you know, straight off the top of their heads, this is my race, this is my ethnicity. There was always some sort of hesitation, or students were always thinking about, you know, their own identities. And so I think that this is something that I gravitate to personally just because of my own identity, but I think it's going to be something that we continue to see as this country becomes more and more diverse. Race is a spectrum, and at any moment, in any, I guess, environment, I can identify as one or the other. It's not, they're not exclusive of each other. So,
Brittany Brown, thank you so much for being here. A newly minted graduate of the University of Mississippi, on to great things, Brittany. I can hear it in your voice. Thank you very much for sharing your senior thesis.
Thank you for having me.
Good luck to you. Thank you. Tim Greaves, stand by. We're talking about the college thesis this hour with graduating seniors from around the country. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with college seniors this hour about their thesis, the last great intellectual exercise for the class of 2019. And you can join the conversation. What makes a good thesis? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got Tim Greve riding along with us this hour. He ran the news division for McClatchy Newspapers. He's now working on a new publication that will focus on technology, business, and politics. Tim, I've got a line of calls here, so let me get a couple in here first. Alex is in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Where are you in the process? Have you graduated? Are you about there?
I graduated last Friday with a bachelor's degree in history.
Aha. Uh-huh. And tell us about your thesis, Alex.
I wrote a thesis about modern perspectives in history and new and changing perspectives in history and how they shape modern policy in the U.S. and Middle East specifically.
And what's your takeaway?
My takeaway from my thesis is that it's really important to constantly reexamine and reassess old historical perspectives in order to gain a proper and full understanding of modern problems in their correct historical context.
And how do you plan to use the knowledge you gained from writing, researching, putting together this senior thesis sort of as you move along? Was this an important exercise for you, I guess is what I'm asking, or was it just sort of a one-off thing?
I think it was actually an extreme exercise. I think a lot of historians, and especially the way history is taught in school today, reflects more of a memorization of just names and dates and places and events rather than understanding that we can change the way that we understand our history based on which historical documents and primary sources we study, and that will greatly, greatly impact and affect the way that we approach history. And as younger children start to learn this approach towards history, they will be elevated to positions of power eventually, and we can change the way our states operate policy-wise towards modern problems.
Well, good luck to you, Alex, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Get another listener in here, Rebecca in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Well, I'm not a newly minted graduate. I actually finished my graduate degree, my doctorate in audiology in 2010 from the University at Buffalo. So I'm an audiologist today practicing in private practice. But at the time, I wrote my thesis on a certain kind of hearing loss, not the hearing loss we all know about, obviously, the kind that happens slowly over the aging process. But this was more called noise-induced hearing loss. And that can come from, obviously, our military, construction workers, you know, people who work in noise that can't otherwise protect themselves because they don't have that option, especially when they're out serving our country, they're in the field. And so my job in my research was to combine different dosages of drugs, antioxidants, and things called SARC inhibitors. And the goal was to kind of come up with a super drug combination that our military could actually dose themselves with after a blast noise exposure that would help promote recovery and compensation of that impact sudden hearing loss.
And so did you see an application of what you developed? Did you see that actually applied?
We did. We did have, you know, I was so excited that we had statistically significant findings. But where I kind of left off with it was that we really needed more research to be done in that area, more grant funding in order to move it to human trial, which was a really difficult jump and getting the approval to do that. So I know others who came after me have kind of taken that research on, but we've not gotten to the point where we have something for our service members just yet.
Mm. Well, an important work came out of a senior thesis. Rebecca, thank you so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me bring in now Matt Hoisch. He's actually in the studio with me. He is from Los Angeles, a senior at Harvard College and on-point intern. Nice to have you with us, Matt. Matt's thesis is titled The Parts and the Whole, a co-productionist analysis of urban carbon neutrality. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Matt. How are you?
Doing well.
So tell us about your thesis, about your senior thesis.
So my thesis was looking at two cities in Texas that are trying to go 100% renewable. And I was really interested in understanding how these two cities in this red state made renewable energy politically palatable for their citizenry and what the challenges were along the way for each city.
How did you find out about these places in the first place?
So I actually found out about Georgetown through I was just listening to the news a few years ago and heard about this city in Texas trying to go 100% renewable. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And so last year when I was trying to think up a topic for my senior thesis, the idea of a Texas city going renewable just seemed so rich and interesting. And like there were so many questions that I had. And so immediately I knew that I had to get a comparative element in there. And conveniently, in February of 2018, when I was doing all this, Denton, another city in Texas, also decided that they were going to go or try to go 100% renewable in the next few years. And so I got very lucky that I had these two cities fairly similar trying to do the same thing that I could look at both of them.
How are they doing it? How are they funding it?
So a lot of it is contractual. They are buying the energy from wind and solar farms in Texas and buying the rights to that energy. And the way that the Texas energy grid works, it's not that the energy is going directly to each city, but the city essentially has the rights to that energy.
Hmm. Which is somewhat controversial.
It is somewhat controversial, but net, I mean, they're, you know, putting the funding forward that ostensibly without this funding, that renewable energy would not have been generated. So in that way, they are offsetting fossil fuel generation.
Mm. Tim Grieve, what do you hear in Matt's thesis?
Well, I'm fascinated by this Texas aspect, as I think you were. Do you think these cities did this because they were in Texas or sort of in spite of their Texasness?
You know, that was one of the interesting things that really attracted me to this, because anyone that knows renewable energy actually knows that it's not that surprising that there are cities in Texas doing this, because Texas has so much wind and sun that renewable energy is actually very plentiful in the state. But I would say that one of the cities, one of the driving factors they were using was saying that this is an economic decision. They were really pushing the economic nature of this decision. And in that way, I would say that the Texas practicality of it all, I think, was really at the forefront of their decision to do this. And then the other city, Denton, had actually had a history of kind of pushing up their renewable energy portfolio bit by bit over the years, part of which I would say is because it's a big university town. They have two big universities in the city, and that kind of, I think, brought a lot of the green ethos into what they were doing. And so I think the Texasness of the two towns created a really fascinating backdrop against which to look at what these two cities were doing.
And so are the citizens in Georgetown and Denton, are they, you know, they must be really proud of this? Do they feel like they're sort of pioneers in some way here?
You know, that's the funny thing. In Georgetown, they actually weren't even trying to go 100% renewable. They made a series of small choices, contract by contract, and more or less one morning woke up and realized when they signed this next contract, they're going to be 100% renewable. And the city,
sort of by accident. Exactly.
Yeah. And the citizens really were on board as long as it didn't change that much. And more or less, once they went renewable, the lights didn't flicker, the energy didn't go out. And most people, I mean, I was in Georgetown, some people didn't even know they were 100% renewable. In Denton, people have been on board with going renewable more or less for a while. They were 40% renewable a few years ago, and a lot of people were really on board to go 100% renewable. But the Denton story gets a little bit more complicated because they actually had to build a natural gas plant in the city in order to go 100% renewable, which what they did with it was they sold that energy, didn't use it, but used the revenue from selling that energy to make their renewable plan economical. And so that got a little bit more complicated.
It's such an interesting story. What are the lessons, more broadly speaking, from Georgetown and Denton, would you say?
I'm going to say that as we move forward with a lot of climate change plans, I think this idea of going 100% renewable is something a lot of people are catching on to. But the thing I've learned from this is that cities are not monoliths. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution kind of a thing. As more and more cities kind of get on to what has historically been, I think, national efforts to combat climate change, we're really going to have to grapple with the fact that cities are different. They're not the same. As people try and implement these plans, I think it is really worthwhile to go into cities to try to understand the cities and really get a more detailed perspective. And before I forget, I also wanted to give a shout out to my thesis advisor, Sheila Jasanoff, who was invaluable in this whole process.
Excellent. Well, congratulations to her and especially to you, Matt Hoisch, Harvard senior and On Point intern. We wish you all the best. It's been so great to have you on our team.
Well, thanks, Jane.
Thank you. So up next, joining us from St. Petersburg, Florida, August Dichter. He graduates from Eckerd College later this week from Philadelphia. His thesis is titled The Political Effectiveness of the Satirical News Desk. August, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And say hi to Tim Grieve.
Hi, Tim, as well. Sorry.
Hey, August.
Go ahead, Tim. You get the first question on this one.
Yeah, well, as a journalist, I'm fascinated by this, the power of these satirical news shows. Were you more interested in their power of helping people understand the news, or their power in persuading people to have a particular viewpoint?
Great question. I was actually an intern on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and I got to see firsthand how powerful the satirical news critique of politics can actually influence people to action and drive a lot of their decisions. And I was really inspired by that in creating this thesis.
So tell us exactly what you did. You had one class watch a couple of different clips in different ways. Explain the process.
Yeah, so I performed a quasi-experimental thing at Eckerd, and I had one class watch a ABC News clip while a different class watched a clip from John Oliver and Last Week Tonight. The clips had essentially the same exact information in them, and I tried to pick a very nonpartisan topic, which was ISIS. Everyone can really, you know, get behind our ideals of ISIS. So then I asked them a couple baseline questions, see where they were politically, and then I asked them about the clip and thoughts on the clip, about the strategic narrative which the different news desks were trying to critique throughout the clip. And then I came back a week later and asked them follow-up questions.
All right. I want to hear the follow-up questions, but I want to play this clip first, August. This is from the 2015 segment of John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, where the comedian focused on Toyota's response to ISIS, featuring their vehicles in promotional videos. So here we hear ABC's Brian Ross first, and then we hear John Oliver's reaction.
In a statement to ABC News, Toyota says it is not aware of any of its dealerships violating the company policy not to sell to terrorist groups.
Hold on. You actually felt the need to make not selling to terrorists official company policy. Is that in the handbook under things that should go without saying? So don't sell to terrorists, don't accept magic beans as payment, and don't sell to a cat who walks in with a ruby in its mouth.
All right, August, so you played these two different clips, and tell us what happened. You came back and asked what?
I asked, first and foremost, were you engaged by the clip? And overwhelmingly, students who were watching the satirical news desk were way more engaged by the clip. They were laughing. They were enjoying it. They enjoyed John Oliver and the ruby in the cat's mouth. They enjoyed the wacky inflatable armed terrorist that he talks about slightly later in that clip as well. I then asked the students if they had gone back to the news sources, the respected news sources, ABC or Last Week Tonight, for more information. And by far, the class that was watching Last Week Tonight, they went back more often than the ABC clip, than the ABC class. And then the last question I asked was, a week later, are you still thinking about the material? And students from the satirical news class were still wrestling with the material. They were still thinking about that material a week later at a far higher rate than the ABC news class.
So, Tim Grief, what do you make of those reactions? That's fascinating.
Well, I'm really curious about the political persuasion of the people in the crowd. So much, many times in these shows, people are pretty self-selecting which kind of show they're going to watch. Were the conservatives in the group able to take away the same amount of information and withhold the same amount of information as the liberals? Given that the presentation probably from John Oliver was probably in a more liberal perspective?
Honestly, I saw that the students who identified more conservatively reject the ABC news clip a little more. And that might be the feelings towards the traditional news desk in general at the moment. But I think that the satirical devices that John Oliver is able to employ brought some more of them in.
So what's the takeaway then, would you say, August, for news organizations, for producers, for a younger generation of news consumers?
I would say satire is not inherently for liberals. It is for everyone because it offers a new in-depth critique of a politician's strategic narrative that you just sometimes cannot get from the traditional news desk. And it's able to generate a consensus of facts on climate change, for example, which the traditional news desk is having trouble doing right now.
Are you a fan of John Oliver? Are you a fan of satirical news yourself?
A very big fan of John Oliver and satirical news myself. I created a satirical newspaper at my college just to have an outlet.
Mm. Well, good for you. Congratulations, August Dichter, senior at Eckerd College. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
You too. Tim, let's get another couple of calls in here. Andy is in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Andy. Welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi. What was your senior thesis on?
My senior thesis was on the imperialist rhetoric of Henry Cabot Lodge. I've read it in about two other people.
Two other people have read it. Right? And did they fall asleep in the process? Yeah. Yeah.
In the archives at the University of Wisconsin Historical Society, if you want to visit.
And I see here you're a professor now. Are you helping students with the process of the senior thesis yourself now?
I have 60 portfolios that I'm grading. These are mini papers. They're upper division writing. This is upper division writing course. So I've advised thesis in the past, but presently I have 60 portfolios to grade. My takeaway from my call is that instructors and students should view the subject matter as a writing problem. After all, the thesis is written, so it's good that the students have a writing problem because if they are forced to write, they'll become clearer in their thinking about their subject.
I'm curious. Do you encourage students now, given your own experience, to try to write a thesis that other people actually will read?
Well, the intention is that they have an audience that would appreciate this type of discourse. It has to be a smart audience that knows the subject matter already, that has excellent critical thinking skills, and, of course, can write well themselves. So I'm hopeful.
Andy, thank you so much. Good luck with those 60 portfolios that you have to look at over the next couple of weeks.
Well, I've enjoyed my mini break. Thank you so much. I enjoy your show.
Andy, thank you very much for calling. Tim Grieve is with us. Stick with us, Tim, journalist who recently ran the news division for McClatchy. We'll have a couple more senior theses after this break. We're discussing the labor of love, sweat, and sometimes tears that is the college thesis. Listeners, we'd love to have you join us. Did your thesis help launch your career? Help you get a job? Was it a waste of time? A waste of paper? More after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with the class of 2019 this hour about their senior theses, and you can join the conversation. Are you inspired? Glad you're on the flip side of this ordeal? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My sidekick on this academic achievement coaster is Tim Grieve, who ran the news division of McClatchy Newspapers and is working on a new publication focused on technology, business, and politics. So far, so good, huh, Tim?
Very impressive group of of thesis, only some of which I understand.
Exactly. I've got a couple more coming, but let's get to some calls. I've got them lined up around the block here. Abby is in South Portland, Maine. Hi, Abby. You're up.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Did you write a thesis?
So I did, many moons ago at this point. So I was a 2003 graduate from St. Anselm College in
New Hampshire. It's not that old. Not that old.
Oh, bless your heart. I'll take it. But my thesis was on stereotype implications from September 11th because it was right there. Mm-hmm. I was in college when that all happened. And so while I don't remember the exact details, essentially, you know, I asked a number of different students. I think it was probably all the freshmen were required to take a number of different questionnaires and the like of different scenarios. And some of the instigators in the scenarios had pictures. They were clearly Caucasian, no insinuation of any other sort of race or color or anything like that. And then same exact scenarios, and they were pictures of people and names associated with Muslim descent. And with just trying to gauge, were their stereotype implications coming and were they stronger, depending on if someone was presented to be Caucasian or, you know, of a different ethnicity. And so the expectation was the somewhat obvious expectation, right? Was, oh, would stereotypes be higher as a result of group as a whole, despite it being just a small group of individuals? And actually the opposite was true, which was incredibly interesting, right? So people were less likely to attribute adverse reactions to someone who was of the group that was of Muslim descent. So, you know, the analysis, and I have to also give a shout out to my professor from many moons ago, and that was Elizabeth Ossoff. And so, you know, we worked through kind of the results, and there was just kind of a phenom going on where people were almost being protective. So they didn't want to, the overreaction was, I don't want to be attribute more stereotypes just simply on the basis of a name or a picture or anything like that. Now, here's what I think is interesting, and this program is actually prompting me to go home and dig that thesis out perhaps and read it if I can find it in my attic. But I do wonder today if you were to have that same type of test presented to the same type of people, you know, the same class of people, if those results would be the same, given the vitriol that abounds in politics. And I do think it's quite interesting. And I think some of the things that the callers today have touched upon is why work like this becomes so important, because one would hope that you can not only learn from the past, but you can educate moving forward too. So how can we talk about public discourse and the impacts it's truly has had? And I do wonder if you could just take a snippet in time from, 15, 16
right,
years
right,
ago and
right.
then apply it to today. I do think it's interesting.
That is interesting. Post online for us when you find that that old thesis and what you think of after you read it. Abby, thank you so much. Let's get Drew in here from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Drew. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet. When was your senior thesis, Drew?
1976. I graduated from Kalamazoo College with a major in history. Did my senior thesis on the Detroit riot of March 6, 1863, during the Civil War. And I want to give a shout out to your earlier caller, Alex, about history is not just memorization and facts and numbers. If you get down into the nitty-gritty and do the research, you realize that today's current events are tomorrow's history. 50 years from now, what's in our news, what's broadcast by Fox, what's broadcast by MSNBC, is going to be studied by somebody doing a thesis.
At some point. Right. Drew, thank you very much for the call from Detroit. Let me bring another one of our graduates into the conversation now from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Sophia Valensky, who just graduated from the University of Minnesota. She's a 21-year-old from New Prague, Minnesota, and her thesis is titled Sexy Unique Reality, a Close Reading of Vanderpump Rules. Sophia, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So, you know, the Vanderpump Rules, it's Tim's favorite program, isn't it, Tim?
Oh,
I will admit I had to look it up today.
For the uninitiated, Sophia, what is Vanderpump Rules?
Yeah, Vanderpump Rules is a reality television show that's broadcast on the network Bravo, and it follows the lives of a bunch of 20 to 40-year-olds who work at a restaurant called SUR, which is, it stands for Sexy Unique Restaurant. And the restaurant is owned by Lisa Vanderpump, who is the namesake character.
All right. So what's the question you were posing in your thesis that you hoped to answer?
Yeah. So when I started, I honestly didn't really know what my question was, and it was more the problem of, can I read a reality show like I would a book?
And can you?
I can, yeah.
All right. How so?
It's hard to explain. You have to, I've realized, utilize all of the elements of a reality TV show. You can't just, I kind of thought at first about just transcribing an episode and seeing if I could analyze it like I would any other of my English assignments. But I realize I have to take into account a lot of other aspects of the show, like people's clothes and how long they're in a scene, background music, and all of that stuff.
All right. Here's a clip from the show Vanderpump Rules. Character James Kennedy here reflecting on an argument with Lala Kent over pasta.
It's not about the pasta. It's not about the pasta. It's about Lala showing respect for my girlfriend. How does Lala expect me to respect her man when she can't respect my lady? It goes hand in hand. Show some respect if you want to get it back, okay? Not giggle after you eat my girl's plate of food.
Tim Grieve, this sounds like a very different kind of senior thesis to me. What do you think?
It really does. I'm reflecting back to my freshman year of college, which really was many moons ago, when one of my professors was unsuccessfully trying to get the university to include Bob Dylan songs in the great work of Western civilization. That didn't work, but I guess Vanderpump Rules does. Now, did doing this project take the fun out of watching TV for you? And did you ever think, like, man, I could be out digging up mud samples like a normal college student?
You know what? I thought that it wouldn't, but it did.
Oh, no.
I'm excited to go. I think that I'll be able to bounce back and just enjoy. But there was an episode that was broadcast last night that I thought maybe since I'm done writing, I can just sit and relax and watch this. And it wasn't the case.
So you're an English major, right, Sophia?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you see this translating, this thesis work translating to a profession or to real life, or do you at all? Is it just, you know, on to watching more Vanderpump?
Oh, I'd absolutely love to do stuff like this in real life. If I could write about reality television forever, that would be my perfect cup of tea.
All right. Well, good luck to you. I hope that works out.
Thank you.
All right, Sophia Valensky, University of Minnesota, graduates on Saturday. Good luck, Sophia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Tim Grieve, we're going to go back to the calls. Jan's in Sarasota, Florida. Hi, Jan. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. Did you write a thesis?
Well, mine, first of all, I graduated in 1972, so it was a while ago.
Okay.
But I thought this would be an interesting perspective because I graduated from the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston.
Oh, yes.
And my senior thesis was a live classical music recital.
Fantastic. And what did you play?
Well, my instrument was the harpsichord. I was a harpsichord student. So I played some very early music. I played a piece by Bach and a piece by Bull and all sorts of other people that you've probably never heard of. But if you think it's nerve-wracking to write a paper, imagine a live performance as the what you have to do to graduate.
And how did it go? Jan, how did it go?
Yeah.
How did it go?
It went great.
Yeah.
It went great, and I graduated, and I had many years as a performing harpsichordist, so it worked great.
Good for you.
And ironically, many years later, when my daughter graduated, she went to an art school, Ringling School of Art and Design, and studied computer animation. So her senior thesis was a piece of computer animation she had to create.
Oh, that's interesting. Ah, great. Well, so the tradition continues.
I thought it'd be kind of fun to see the perspective of what it's like for artists and musicians. They have to also present something.
Love it. Jan, thank you so much for calling. That's a great perspective. Let me bring in now, which is actually a good lead-in to our next graduate from Meadville, Pennsylvania, Catherine Hubert, a graduate of Allegheny College. She's from Pennsylvania. The title of her thesis is MuSpeak, American Music Language. Catherine, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You just heard from Jan, who years ago did her senior thesis as a concert at NEC, New England Conservatory, here in Boston. Tell us about your thesis, about MuSpeak. How did you develop it?
Yeah, so for centuries, philosophers and linguists have been debating whether music in its current state can function as a language. And their main argument against this is the fact that music, in the instrumental sense, cannot make direct assertions. That is, the musical experience is subjective. And so to try to fix that problem, I created MuSpeak, which is a translational tool that takes English and converts it to American music language.
Hmm. So tell us more about that. It translates? Translates what exactly?
Yeah, so with this system, you could take English text and using a plethora of rules I've developed, take English text and convert it to pitches and music. So the music that you hear is actually the English language that's been translated. So in a sense, that sense, music can make direct assertions and function on its own as a language.
So in theory, you could sing the word hello to us?
You'd need more than one person to, but yes, you could.
Why would you need more than one person?
So as part of this system, each English letter corresponds to a musical pitch. And so there are 26 letters in the English alphabet and only 12 musical pitches. And so in order for a word to sound, you need to be able to stack the pitches. So imagine words are vertical now, and hello is spelled H at the top, E-L-L-O. And you need to have a pitch for every single one of those letters so the listener knows that the word hello is holistic. So you'd either need to play the piano or find five people. Does that make sense?
Wow. Words are vertical. I love it. So
sounds like a very slow way to communicate.
Yeah, it's not practical at all. and it doesn't sound
To be in college.
Yeah. But it did solve the problem, right? Music can now, I think I could say music is now a language, right? We could have those direct assertions.
So you actually translated Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart into MuSpeak, right?
I did, just part of it.
I'm going to play a bit of it. Set this up for us. What are we going to hear here, Catherine?
Yes. So the whole fundamental basis of the system is really based around the fact that there are universal emotions, one of which is anger. And so these emotions are paired with musical modes, which there are seven of. And a mode is like a scale, and it has certain feelings that give it unique properties. And so in post-peace, the overall emotion is clearly anger. Spoiler alert, for those of you who don't know, the narrator goes on to kill an old man out of rage. So what you're going to hear is the translated text, which will be in the trumpet, French horn, trombone, euphonium, violin, and tuba.
All right.
And so when you hear those instruments, those are what's carrying post-translation.
All right.
There's also a bass drum representing the heartbeat and other accompaniment to enhance the translation.
All right, James, roll it. Wow. So again, words are vertical, and they're represented here. Each word has a representative musical note, I guess, right?
Yes.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And it's not pretty by any means.
Yeah.
I think Taylor Swift doesn't have anything to worry about just at the moment, right? Can you listen to this and translate it backwards in your head so you can hear the music and understand what's being what the words were?
Yes, and I don't know if that's a product of me just spending countless hours writing this or me actually being able to translate quickly.
Wow. You know, I wanted to end with your very compelling personal story, Catherine. Tell us why you decided to do this. I've got about a minute left here.
So I have a condition called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It's a collagen disorder, and collagen's essentially the glue that holds your body together, and so mine doesn't work properly, which means I have a lot of problems like chronic pain and fatigue. And one of the things that makes my condition worse is repetitive movements. And so as a percussionist, that means I can't really keep playing because I'll just be damaging my body. And so in order to shift away from playing but still stay, keep music a part of my life, I designed this system and I'm moving more towards composition.
Mm. And we should say you're not just a recent graduate of Allegheny College, but you're a soon-to-be PhD candidate in genetics at the University of Wisconsin. Well, good luck to you, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for bringing us MuSpeak today. We really appreciate it. And Tim Grieve, we couldn't do this without you every year. Best of luck with your new venture and your college kids are probably going to be writing these pretty soon.
So true. We got two almost done and one more on the way. So I'm in thesis city here.
Yeah, well, good luck. And thanks again, Tim.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks to you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.